them a question of choice. It was often governed by forces inside and outside of ourselves. But I was too tired and too distraught by all that had gone on to really care which outcome was produced. As before, I also gave some thought to fleeing, but knowing who I was dealing with and powers they likely possessed, running away seemed fruitless. They'd be able to track me down if they wanted to. At least in Las Vegas, I had my core group of friends who had my best interest at heart. Though I woke up the next morning and initially felt like I wanted to just sleep the rest of the day and many others away, duty called. Despite being freaked out the previous night by Dennis's call, I had remembered to grab a packet of photos that Gene needed. I set out early for his office. I stopped at a cafe for a quick bite to eat and sat there nervously looking around the room for any signs of suspicious activity. I stopped doing that pretty quickly when I realized that I didn't have a firm grasp of what might constitute suspicious activity. I finished up and left, scanning the newspapers in the box outside the cafe. Nothing on the front page indicated that my story had been important enough to be above the fold, and maybe not even anywhere in the paper. I chided myself for thinking I was such a big deal and headed over to Gene's office. I walked in, and another man was with him.
"Bob," Gene said, "this is Gene."
"How you doing?" the man said. "I'm an appraiser, too. Weird, isn't it? Gene, like you stepped into another universe." In fact, the man looked nothing at all like Gene. His olive complexion and thinning black hair splayed across his pate in dark isosceles clumps. "I know. How about this? Gene, the dancing machine. Remember that show with Chuck Barris, The Gong Show?" the man said. "Sorry, I don't." Gene number two narrowed his gaze and cocked his head. "Hey, this guy," he said, directing his remarks to Gene, "sounds like the guy I saw on the news last night."
"Nah, I don't know. I saw it, but I don't hear the similarity. He's just the photo guy."
I shrugged and said, "Just the photo guy." When we were alone, I said to Gene, "That's a bit scary. I thought about them using a voice disguiser, but didn't think it was necessary. Now this?" Gene tried to reassure me that it was a fluke, and he was eventually proved right. Over the course of the next few days and into June, no one else claimed that I sounded like the alien guy on TV. In the years to come, I'd learn that the brief bit of footage that aired that night eventually made its way to various locations around the globe. I thought I had some sense of the power of the media and mass communications back then, but didn't realize what a greater force it would become and how it would directly impact my life. My friends took on a more low-tech campaign on my behalf. Gene and a few others, suspecting that his phone line was now being tapped as well, started to talk more openly over the phone about what I'd been doing. He called friends and family, enlarging the circle of those in the know. The idea was simple. If Dennis and others decided that I was such a security risk that I needed to be killed, and more people knew what it was that I was doing, having those individuals with that knowledge could either act as a deterrent or increase the number of people who would know the truth of why I had been killed. The fact that I was eliminated, we believed, would confirm the truth of what I had revealed. In their conversations with others, my inner circle also stated that they had written letters to members of various agencies with the government, etc. These communications, the letters, would be far more difficult to track and interfere with. We felt that simply giving the appearance of having communicated more widely was enough to keep those who might want to do me harm at bay. We were going to keep them guessing as to who knew what, and created our own kind of disinformation campaign. I was still being followed and monitored, and Gene reported to me that he believed he had been tailed as well. I can't confirm this, and neither could Gene, but it certainly was within the realm of possibility. The kinds of gamesmanship that was going on was never fun or thrilling. It was always frightening and aggravating. I don't know if Dennis felt the same way, but eventually, on the third Saturday in June, the 17th, after having been contacted by Dennis that a personal-level meeting was needed, we set a time and place for a face-to-face meeting. At my suggestion, we were to meet at 8 in the evening at the Union Plaza Casino in downtown Las Vegas. The more public the location, the better, and a Las Vegas casino on a Saturday night was sure to be crowded. As it happened, a friend and former colleague from Los Alamos, Joe Vaninetti, was in town. He knew what was going on generally with me. Gene and I brought him up to speed on the most recent events, and Joe helped us with our planning for the meeting with Dennis. I wasn't about to go there alone. I also wasn't about to expose my friends to any more jeopardy than necessary. I didn't think that Dennis or whoever might have been with him, or at whose urging the meeting was set up, intended to do me harm at the casino. But as a scientist, you know that you should never jump to any conclusions. We devised a plan so that Joe and Gene could keep me in sight at all times, or at least be able to track my location. The day of the meeting, I spent quietly at home reading. I'd resumed my activities at the library. Prior to going to work out at S4, and for most of my adult life, I hadn't earned enough money to afford subscriptions to all the scientific journals and periodicals that I wanted to read in order to keep current on latest advances. As I recall, even back then, the wonderful, though not highly technical magazine Nature cost nearly $20 an issue. Some of the less popular ones, like the Journal of Technical Physics, were somewhat obscure, but its peer-reviewed articles were fascinating to me. I struggled with my focus that day, but being in a library had a calming effect on me. But you know you've got a lot on your mind when an article on microsecond plasma pulses in MW range can't hold your attention. I sat there watching the odd assortment of characters who frequent the library. I suppose that people who don't live in Las Vegas and only visit the Strip don't really think about the daily lives of its residents, let alone libraries. In the days before the Internet exploded with information that we could access so easily, libraries were still an interesting gathering place for those who pursued esoteric as well as commonplace knowledge. I thought a bit about the site of our meeting. The Union Plaza Hotel sat on the site of the former Union Pacific Railroad station. The hotel still had a train station as part of its structure. I sought out photos of the older version, built in 1940, and admired its Art Moderne, or Streamline Moderne, facade, a later variation of the Art Deco movement. In the photographs I saw, the station's single-story front that faced Main Street looked like the diner that Edward Hopper depicted in his great painting, Nighthawks. Something always captivated me about that painting. The couple sitting at the counter, the lone man with his back to the viewer, the counterman going about his business. It sometimes struck me as desperately lonely, and at other times, hopeful. Those people had some place that they could go, even if they didn't speak, some place where they could find some fellowship. We don't build great cathedrals much anymore, and our artists don't tend to depict them in their works the way painters centuries ago once did. I was in a reflective mood, obviously, while also trying to make sense of my present. I can't say that I ever uttered the words, "Why me?" when it came to my dealings with Naval Intelligence, EG&G, and Dennis as the representative of some larger body of people. I simply accepted what had happened. And in those moments, as I flipped through that book depicting some early scenes of Las Vegas and its development, I allowed myself to feel some sense of loss at what had transpired. I'd been privileged to work at S4 and had seen a technological marvel that defied my complete understanding. In a way, I was like some pilgrim who traveled to Chartres in France in the 13th century and had seen the marvels of the flying buttress and wondered how it was done, and maybe worried that it might all come crashing down on my head, but believed that, no, God in His goodness was holding that high ceiling aloft, Or maybe I was like someone who lived long enough to come to Las Vegas and arrive at the Union Pacific Railroad station aboard a locomotive, powered by a means that was a marvel of its time, internal combustion and electromechanical. The streamliners of that era were capable of an astounding 100 miles an hour. We'd made progress, to be sure, and who was to say what a race from a distant galaxy might have been able to accomplish if they'd been around longer or hadn't been around as long, but possessed an intellect superior to our own. As much as I said that I wanted all of this to be over and wondered how my meeting with Dennis might lead me toward or away from that goal, I was saddened by the end of the opportunity I'd been given. I was sad about the end of my marriage. I don't know if I had any real innocence left to be able to lose it, but I wished that in all that had gone on, there was more time to just simply marvel at it all, to take in the beauty and elegant simplicity of the propulsion system, to appreciate it for what it was, and not think of it so much as a problem to be solved, but a gift that I could take pleasure in. I knew that the time for my appointment with Dennis was nearing. The library emitted a signal it was last call. I slid the periodicals back on their shelves, in defiance of the request to return them to the front desk. I went home and walked through each of the rooms, thinking a bit about Tracy and our time there together. Sometimes things change, but they aren't always a sign of progress. Before I knew it, it was time to leave. Joe, Jean, and I all climbed into Joe's vehicle and headed into downtown Vegas. By the time the glittering lights of the hotel were visible, my stomach was in knots. As much as I was concerned for the personal safety of us all, I knew that there were a lot of forms that the "Do you know what we can do to you?" question could take. I could easily imagine having all my financial records messed with, my education and employment history disappearing, all of which wouldn't be mere inconveniences, but could really damage me and ruin my life. I felt like I'd already lost so much and was going to have to start over in so many ways that it felt overwhelming. Stepping into the noisy cacophony of a Vegas casino was a bit of sensory overload, given my exile at John's house and my time at the library. I truly did feel like I was under assault, that the loud noises, the flashing lights, the loud thrum of conversations pierced by sharp laughter produced a physical pain in my head and throughout my body that had me gritting my teeth. As per our plan, I'd entered alone and began to scout for Dennis. At 3-minute intervals, Jean and then Joe would enter the casino, chose strategically advantageous seats at the slot machines, and keep an eye on me. I'd described Dennis to them both, but I didn't want them approaching him. I kept up my reconnoitering the slot room and other parts of the casino, dodging waitresses and patrons in the narrow openings between the games and tables. After waiting 15 minutes and wondering if the rules applied about a professor being late to a class, I found a staff member to assist me with a request. I asked that someone page Dennis Mariana and ask him to meet his party at the entrance to the blackjack room. Several minutes later, I saw Dennis working his way from the entrance toward where I'd been standing along a sidewall. He was part of a large clump of people trying to make their way deeper into the casino. He looked exactly as he always did, unsmiling, eyes focused straight ahead, his neat mustache, hair, and erect posture hardly allowing him to blend in with the more casual and relaxed patrons. I walked toward him, making myself very clearly present in front of him, my heart rate climbing and my throat tightening. Dennis walked right past me, not acknowledging me in the slightest. My eyes darted from side to side, and I noticed another man, his presence very much like Dennis's as he stood stiffly along the wall not far from where I'd previously been standing. I looked at him again, stared at him, and realized that he was one of the security people I'd seen while at S4. It made sense to me that Dennis wasn't going to be alone. I saw that Joe and Jean were both looking in my direction. I tried to point out Dennis to them both, but knew that given the cluster of people moving through the area, it was going to be hard for them to positively identify which man he was. I walked over to Joe and then to Jean, letting them know what I wanted to do next. Jean, I'm going to go in there, into the blackjack room, and I want you to follow me. Stay out of sight, but keep an eye on Dennis.
I saw him, Bob. I spotted a guy who I think matched the description.
Good, but I want you to be more positive, undeniably positive about the identification. I'm going to speak with him, and I need you to witness that, to have zero doubt in your mind that the man I was talking to was Dennis.
Got it.
Jean trailed behind me. To my right, I saw Dennis sitting at a table. I inclined my head toward him to let Jean know I'd spotted the guy. I also held up my hand briefly to remind Jean that I didn't want him to approach Dennis at all. It was nearly comical to see Dennis in that environment. He was sandwiched between two curvaceous women who were both enjoying their drinks and the festive atmosphere. I watched Dennis for a minute or so, and he never took his eyes off his cards, a remarkable feat of self-restraint. I circled the blackjack pit and came up behind Dennis. For some reason, by this time, whatever anxiety I was feeling seemed to disappear. The dealer eyed me suspiciously. He'd seen me circling and looking at the table. I could have easily been eyeing everyone's cards, a stupid and blatantly obvious cheat, but not one I was working.
"Well, Dennis, you said you wanted to meet, and here I am. What's the deal?"
I spoke loud enough to ensure that the dealer heard me. He was some 6 to 8 feet away. I saw his expression soften at my words. Dennis didn't react at all. I waited a minute before I said to Dennis,
"Dennis, what the hell is going on? What is this shit?"
I stared at the back of Dennis's head, noticed an ingrown hair that had begun to boil the skin in a small but angry red welt. Aware that creating some kind of scene was not wise, I walked away. Jean joined me on the edge of the pit, edging out from behind a slot machine. Dennis remained in our sightline.
"What the hell was that?"
Jean asked. "I don't know. More bullshit from them. From him."
"What do you want to do?"
Jean asked. "I don't know what we can do. He doesn't want to talk. He hasn't told me where we could meet. Nothing."
"Do you want to tail him? Follow him to his car? At least get his license number?"
I was so frustrated and let down at that point, so sick of Dennis's arrogance, that I agreed to that plan, knowing it really wouldn't do us one bit of good. But at least it was something. Dennis stood up from the table and merged into the crowd. We all moved to follow him, but in just a few seconds, the crowd swallowed him up. Jean and I made our way toward the front entrance, near Joe's position.
"Did you see anybody who looked like Dennis leaving?"
Joe shook his head and shrugged.
"Not really."
"Not really, or no?"
I sounded more agitated than I really was.
"Sorry, Bob. Nobody that looked like your guy came past."
"Split up and find them?"
Jean asked.
"Why not?"
I said. We each took off in solo pursuit. I checked all the tables, the bathrooms, even stuck my head inside a bar and a restaurant nearby. Not a single sign of him. After 20 to 30 minutes, I wandered back to the entrance. Jean and Joe eventually showed up.
"I could use a drink," Jean said.
"Not here," I told him. We drove to a small tavern nearer my house than the joints along the strip or downtown.
"Why would he do that?"
Jean asked.
"He asked for the meeting. He had backup with the other guy."
"I guess we shouldn't assume that the other security guy was with Dennis. Easy enough to think he was, but not necessarily true." Joe's face lit up in recognition of what I was suggesting.
"So, Dennis says he wants to talk to you personally. He shows up, sees the same guy you do. Now he's thinking that he's being watched. He talks to you, he's in the shit with somebody else above him."
"Could be," I said. I swirled the ice in my glass and held it up to the light.
things are about as opaque as this.
I'm not a gambling man when it comes to people's actions, but I'm pretty sure that Dennis will be back in touch, Gene said.
I wonder if he's as confused by all of this as you are, Bob, Joe added. That may be. I've got no evidence to say one way or the other. Until he tells me it's so, it's all conjecture. I was definitely disappointed at how the evening turned out. I knew that there were a lot more unpleasant alternative endings to it, but as with so much of what had gone on, this felt far too incomplete, far too fragmented to really feel satisfying, far too much like how life generally makes us all feel. If I was hoping for closure on the experiences I had with the people who hired me to reverse-engineer that propulsion system, including Dennis, I wasn't going to get it. Not then, not ever. Unfortunately for me, EG&G, S4, and all the rest of that drama was just one part of the ongoing unraveling of my life. Even though the failed meeting with Dennis resulted in the end of the surveillance teams watching me and my house, I still took some precautions in the weeks and months to come. Among those was taking different routes when I went to the gym, went to Gene's office, or just continued to do my job processing film and the pickups and drop-offs that entailed. Even though there were no more incidents of my car being broken into or someone running me off the road and firing shots at my tires, those incidents had already exacted a toll. I felt like I constantly had to have my head on a swivel, and the paranoia those experiences induced contributed to my stress. In the aftermath of that first broadcast, Tracy moved out of the house. That made me terribly sad, but I wasn't going to stop her. She'd betrayed me by having an affair, but that didn't mean that I couldn't work toward forgiving her and ultimately get there. Though she moved out, we continued to talk. We decided that we should speak with a counselor and made arrangements to do that. We sat down in his office, and he asked us to describe what had been going on and how it was that we ended up in his office. All went well for a while, but I could see a cloud of disapproval or disbelief move across his face when Tracy talked about her affair and how my working with alien spacecraft and having government agents watching us all the time contributed to her infidelity. We each got a chance to talk about what we hoped to accomplish and what we'd been through. At the end of the session, the therapist sat for a few seconds. He bridged his hands in front of himself and leaned back in his chair. Then he turned away for a moment to make a few more notes. The only sound in the room was the scratching of his pen across the page. The light through the window cast a saucer-shaped shadow on the carpet. He looked back at the two of us after that and said, "There's nothing I can do for the two of you. I don't want to see you again." Tracy and I looked at one another completely stunned. We got up and slinked out of the room. Once we got inside the car, we sat there for a second before we both burst out laughing. "We got fired," Tracy said. "That's not good when your therapist fires you." We didn't try to find another counselor, but it eventually became clear that as I got involved in doing more interviews, that whatever damage I'd done to the relationship and what she'd done wasn't something we both were truly invested in fixing. We decided it was best to just go our own ways and not make anything more difficult for the other person. I'd lost one wife to disease and now a second one to work and infidelity. No matter how strong you think you are mentally, or how amicable the parting, a divorce preys on your sense of self and self-worth. A few of the why me moments, why did I have to accept that job, why did she have to have an affair and mess up my chances, and a host of others, brought me pretty low. I understood why some people chose to end their lives. I didn't feel any of the suicidal impulses, but on an intellectual level, I could understand the desire and the despair that might lead to it. As much as was possible, I tried to resume my normal activities as soon as I could after the initial broadcast George had done. I knew immediately, even in those pre-internet days, the power of the media. 2 days after that first interview aired, George was on the phone with me. "Listen, this story is getting picked up around the world. A Japanese station called me. They want to fly you over there and conduct their own interviews with you." "Japan," I said dully. For an instant, the thought appealed to me. I could get away from here and escape everything. "Yeah, pretty amazing. What do you think?" George asked. His voice twinged with a mixture of curiosity and trepidation. "No, not interested." "Mind if I ask why?" "You're the investigative journalist. You figure it out." George laughed. "That's good. That's funny." At the time, I wouldn't have been able to tell you if I was joking or not. I was feeling deadened. It was like I was an unplugged electric guitar. Someone could pluck at a string, but it produced a pale imitation of the sounds it was capable of producing. "Well, Bob, I'm kind of glad to hear that. I mean, the exposure is great. That's one of the reasons why I called." I knew he expected me to respond to that some way, ask what he wanted or something to that effect. I just let the silence linger. "So the response here has been great. We'd like to do more interviews with you." Again, I didn't respond. At least, not directly. "I've thought about the Japan trip. I think I'd like to do it. Maybe it would be good to get away." "That's great. I'll see about the arrangements. What about my offer? More interviews?" George waited and then filled in the gaps. To his credit, he didn't sound exasperated or panicked. "As you can imagine, some people are a little skeptical. Anyone could have made up what you said. We didn't get into much detail. To be honest, I need to be convinced. I need better evidence. I need to verify some things." "Yeah. As I'm sure you know, this story has implications beyond you, beyond me for that matter. This is big stuff. Government cover-ups. This is the kind of thing I do. If you're going to trust anyone about this, I'm your guy." We both let the pause go on. I understood what he was saying. At first, coming forward was an act of self-preservation. I had only briefly considered what all this meant beyond me being able to get back to my life. I did understand that some people believed in a greater degree of transparency within the government than I did. I had a long history of working with and inside government agencies. I was comfortable with the need-to-know mentality that drove much of the control of information. I'd seen that in action in the private sector as well. But with this, I was leaning in a slightly different direction. I didn't really see the harm that would come from revealing this information. It sounded to me as if the Russians were already in the know. I thought that people would be receptive to knowing about alien life and technologies. After all, we had these craft in our possession, and it was like they were shot down in some large-scale invasion. I still didn't know how we got them, and in truth, how didn't matter. We had them, so let's just move on and see how this technology could assist us. Maybe if I put a bit more pressure on the powers that be, they might be willing or might be forced to make this information more well-known. I thought about Sputnik. When we learned the Russians had a space program, and then that they'd gotten a man to orbit the Earth before we did, the result proved to be a net positive, a huge net positive, down the line. Obviously, this situation was different, but I thought that the principle still applied. An open exchange of information could be a good thing. I'd seen firsthand at S4 and in other work what happened when compartmentalization of information took precedence over other considerations. Progress slowed. I had a pretty good idea of the weapons potential of this anti-gravity system. If we had it, and others knew we had it, maybe our having such an enormous advantage would be a real game changer. It had been 10 years since the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks II treaty had been signed. talks to end the Cold War were ongoing, various Soviet republics had been rising in opposition to Kremlin rule. Momentum seemed to be in our favor, but we could have had a heavy weight to tip the balance in our favor. I told George that I would think about it and get back to him.
Don't think about it too long. I'd rather do this with your cooperation. News business is tricky. People forget.
I didn't tell him that people forget, but that groups and agencies like I had been dealing with most likely didn't. After George and I spoke, I called John Lear to let him know that I was going to take him up on his offer. I told him that I would meet him for dinner not later than 6 o'clock that evening. John understood that agreeing to dinner at 6 o'clock meant I would be staying at his house that night. A minor precaution against eavesdropping, but a necessary one at the time. I spoke briefly with John about George's offer to do more interviews. He thought it would be wise to do them. I consulted with a few other friends, but to be honest, by the time I did, my mind was already made up. I was going to go forward with the plan to talk about what I'd seen. I also agreed with something that George told me. For this story to have any credibility, I needed to step up and allow myself to be interviewed on camera and have my likeness and name be clearly on display. The first interview I'd been silhouetted and not identified. That wasn't going to pass the test this time. I told him that I would allow that. George also said that it was his professional responsibility as a journalist to do more inquiring into my past. I agreed to that. George said that he would like to travel with me to Los Alamos to meet some of the people I worked with and to see where I had worked. I agreed to that. George told me that if at any time I was uncomfortable with any of this, up to the moment it was sent out over the air, he'd agree to pull the plug on it. I heartily agreed with that. In fact, I told him that if he hadn't specified that part of the agreement, I wouldn't have agreed to any of the other stipulations. I also spoke with Gene about the Japan trip and asked him if he would like to join me. In the intervening day since the offer was first presented, I'd had second thoughts, but Gene seemed to think it was a good idea. At that point, I was easily swayed and was likely just looking for reasons from other people to do or not do many things. I got another offer that I couldn't refuse. George had contacted the people in Japan to let them know that Gene and I agreed to accept their offer. A few days later, we bought tickets. That same night, I was at home and the phone rang. I picked up and a voice I couldn't identify said, "If you take this trip to Japan, you will never return. Understand?" He then hung up. I didn't know if this meant I was still being followed or if my phone line was still being tapped. Not that either of the two mattered. Gene and I talked it over, and since neither of us was all that excited about going in the first place, we turned in the tickets and didn't go. The Japanese later threatened to sue for the entire cost of their TV special, which I just ignored. I never heard from anyone about it again. I guess it's a reflection of what my state of mind was at the time that the threatening phone call unnerved me only to the point that I canceled the trip. I didn't pursue any other course of action. No going to the authorities, no going on the record about it and telling George. The reason George wanted me to accompany him to Los Alamos was to speed up the process. For him to get the clearances himself, to make all the necessary arrangements would have taken a lot of time. He wanted to strike, as the saying goes, while the iron was hot. I also met with his boss, the station manager, and both of them struck me as consummate professionals. They'd agreed to the conditions I'd mandated for the first interview, and everything had gone off as planned. As much as I was drifting at that point in my life, as much as I was feeling unmoored from the life I'd once led just a few short months before, it was great to have the two of them and my friends in my corner. No matter what happened as a result of the additional exposure, I was comfortable with accepting whatever consequences came my way. I was never going to blame anyone else for being complicit in what happened. I made my choice, and I was going to stick with it. It felt good to be able to trust someone and to trust myself. The trip to Los Alamos was relatively brief. Because I'd worked there and had contracted with them, access to the facility and to the people who could verify my presence there was a relatively easy matter. I took George around and introduced him, showed him places I'd worked and various aspects of the accelerator. George was clearly pleased to see that I hadn't fabricated a bit of my backstory. We returned to Las Vegas, and George said that he would be in touch to schedule the next taping session. We scheduled it for the last week of May, just prior to Memorial Day. We filmed in an office at the studio. I decided that since I wasn't going to have my image disguised, I should make myself as presentable as possible. I wore a gray shirt and a matching thin gray tie. I didn't want to dress too businesslike, so I wore a pair of jeans and white running shoes. Gene didn't prepare me ahead of time with a list of questions, and that was fine with me. We talked at length, but I knew that he was going to have to edit it all down to about 90 seconds for broadcast. I wasn't nervous. Blocking out the camera operator and the sound person wasn't easy. We were in a fairly tight space, but I kept reminding myself that I was having a conversation with George and no one else. He was somebody I trusted, and all I had to do was answer honestly and talk to George. I stuck around the studio while George went into another part of the facility to do his editing. I'm not sure why, but I wanted to be there in person when that evening's news, with my interview included, went out over the airwaves. As time went on, I thought more and more about what I was doing. I was kind of like a groom sitting in a church office while his bride and everybody else bustled about making the last preparations before a wedding. All of them were occupied with doing something, but all I could do was sit there and drink. I started off picking up a pencil and drumming it on the tabletop while considering everything I had done and what this new revelation might mean for my future. I had no idea, really, of how far-reaching the consequences might be. I didn't believe I'd be in any real physical harm. That was the initial thought I'd had in coming forward, that I should do this and protect myself. I wondered a bit about my reputation in Las Vegas and dismissed that as a concern pretty quickly. Las Vegas was a place where many people led a transient existence. They came here with some kind of dream or ideal or last resort mentality. It was kind of like the gambling that drew a lot of people to the place. You started out with high hopes, went bust, and limped home. I was concerned about making a living beyond photo processing. I'd signed up with EG&G, hoping to get back into the scientific community. I wasn't sure how I'd be perceived if I came forward. I'd damaged my chances at getting the security clearance I'd needed to work at S4. But what about at other places, like Los Alamos? What about in the private sector? That was a real unknown. That concerned me. I knew that I'd take a kind of fuck-it-all attitude in the wake of Tracy and the rest of it, but I had to be practical. I was gutted, that was for sure, but there was some instinct inside of me, some sense of survivorship that kept nagging at me. No, I wasn't going to kill myself, but was I doing something that would cripple me in a way? Was I committing some act of self-sabotage? Was I looking for an easy way out, a way to later explain whatever state of failure I'd entered into? I had been pacing for a good amount of time as I waited for the countdown to airtime. There was something inside me that hated the idea of having Dennis and the rest of them, whoever they were, win. I thought that maybe by coming forward in the manner I had, I'd done just that, beaten them. But in reality, that wasn't likely to be the case. I was pretty sure that as I sat there in that room, there was someone else out at the facility filling out the same paperwork I had, submitting to the same physical, getting introduced to Barry or some other version of Barry. The golf ball would still be hitting the ceiling and raining down bits of acoustical tile. The high-performance tests would still be going on every Wednesday night. I wouldn't be a part of any of that. What would I be a part of? I felt a gnawing in my stomach and envisioned a gaping black hole that was my future. Someone knocked at the door. "We're about to go with it," someone I hadn't met before told me. "If you'll follow me." We walked through the aisles of the newsroom along rows of desks and half walls. I spotted George a few yards ahead of me. He carried a large format video cassette in his hand. I took off after him.
"George, no, you can't," I yelled.
"We have to go with this," George said. His eyes darted from side to side, and he'd edged around a file cabinet, and a potted plant wobbled unsteadily.
"You said up to the last second, just say the word."
George was still on the move. I accelerated and caught him around the waist and chest and tackled him.
"I'm saying the word, George. No!"
We rolled around on the floor, George holding the tape just outside my grasp. I looked up and saw a few faces staring down at us, though no one stepped in to intervene.
"We have a deal," I said, sounding very much like a prepubescent boy shouting at his older brother.
George scrambled to his feet.
"I'm doing the right thing, Bob. You know, cold feet is all. This is going to be okay."
With that, he went into the studio, and I sat on the floor with my head cradled in my hands and my knees drawn up, wondering not for the first time or the last, what have I done? In the last 27 years, I've asked myself that question many, many times. Unlike a lot of people who've lived through a really rough period and come out on the other side who say, "If I had to do it over again, I wouldn't change a thing," I would. I wouldn't have come forward. I should have probably just waited things out after learning about Tracy's affair. I would have been more patient and lived with the hope that once that matter was all settled, I could have gone to work at S4 full-time. I had a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to work at the forefront of science, and I pissed it away. Sure, there were the ethical implications of what was going on out there, but at heart, I'm a scientist. I seek knowledge and understanding. All that's been left in the wake of my time at S4 is other people's doubts and uncertainties about me and about the program there. As a scientist, on one level, you have to accept that there's going to be uncertainty, that your theories and findings could always eventually be proven to be less than 100% certain. Simultaneously, you also have to believe that you've cracked the code, solved the riddle, advanced human understanding. At S4, I didn't do any of that. I have to live with that regret, and a bunch of others as well. This is no fairy tale. We all didn't live happily ever after. A lot of innocent people got hurt as a result of me stepping forward. People lost security clearances, jobs, possible futures, because of their association with me and my revealing to them what I did. That's hard to deal with, but is in no way as hard as the consequences they had to face. Over the years, I've tried to do what I can to make amends, but words fall short and gestures fail. As for me, I picked up the pieces eventually. Over the long haul, things did get better. I've spoken a few times at conferences and done some interviews. I've had Hollywood film and TV producers contact me. In the scripts they've written, they've tried to show me as some kind of action hero, leaping onto the hoods of cars, escaping the bad guys. I'm no action hero. I wasn't then, and I'm certainly not one now. I'm no kind of hero. I've settled into a quiet life running a scientific supply company. I can't do science anymore now that my reputation has turned to crap. I've tried sending out resumes, but they produce no results, not even a polite decline. Just silence. The deep silence of space. I chose to come forward again and hoped to set the record straight by writing this. I didn't seek someone out. He sought me. I knew that this was going to be part of a larger, overarching project, and I liked that idea. I was just one small cog in a larger machine at S4, and S4 is part of a larger story as well. I can't and won't comment on that because it is not something I witnessed or experienced myself. I'm a modest guy with modest ambitions. All I've ever done in interviews and appearances is to comment on and to relate what I know and what I did. I see no reason to change that now. I imagine that anyone caught up in events that feel larger than themselves feels the impulse to create a story that is in ways as large as the forces that are acting on them. I guess that's a part of physics. But I know that our understanding of the nature of the universe is, to put it mildly, incomplete. Maybe there's some comfort in knowing that this story is over. Maybe some will take comfort in feeling that there are some questions yet to be answered. That's life. In the end, though, I was rewarded for my patience and my perseverance. I'm married now and have a lovely wife and step-grandkids. None of them know me as the Area 51 guy, and that's just fine with me. This concludes Dreamland by Bob Lazar, narrated by Barry Abrams. Copyright 2000.